think it would be appropriate for me to extend a word of appreciation for the support that as a committee, both members and the support staff, you gave me during the most difficult moment. And I know that you did it because you treated me as one of the family. You have been one of the people I've been associated with now for the past 4 years. And I hope and wish that that's the spirit we could keep. Not that I wish someone else can also go through what I've been through, but if it does, we should continue to keep a similar spirit. Well, I won't lie and say I'm okay. I'm trying, but there are other things even post the events. Probably my father's one is not the worst. There are others that still remain even when you are gone through, which at this stage one won't say anything because of the sensitive nature that they have. But I hope I will still be able to pull through. And thank you to the officials from the department and to the minister. Please extend my word of appreciation. And to the deputy minister, unfortunately, when he wanted to go, I was still not there. So he was that side, I was on the other side trying to put things together. Thank you for what they've done. Secondly, I think it's appropriate also that when we are going to deal with some of these issues, unfortunately, honorable members, I missed a lot of things during that process, I must say. I've only realized now that it's almost 3 weeks that has gone by. And before I say this, I'm never, and I've got no intention whatsoever. I tried to raise that concern with the secretary, and she also said it was beyond their control. The committee can continue even in the absence of the chair. I may be a chair, but I don't want to be that type of a chairperson who puts things on hold as long as it's not there. But I understand why, after she gave me the briefing of the challenges that members were faced with subsequent to that, including the budget vote debate that people were dealing with. So I do understand those logistical issues. I was just concerned about the fact that an impression might be left that if the chairperson is not there, the committee will be on hold. But I know on many occasions members have continued even when the chairperson is not there. But I must say also, as we are dealing with those things, I've grown to develop some fond relations for this portfolio, including being jealous. Sometimes I may be too subjective even when there is a discussion, when things are going on the other side. You know, when you meet people say you are doing this and this from another committee, you may fall on a trap to want to defend even things that are not of your own creation. One of the things which I don't know whether is a coincidence is the fact that we'll be dealing with this thing. I think it's proper from this committee to also extend words of condolences to the mine workers that we lost at Stillwater Sibanye during that period. I think it's one of the extreme incidents that have happened in the industry over a long time. I don't remember since I've been a chairperson of this committee where you had more than five, ne? What was the highest number? Was it Sasali, two, ne? Yes, four. Five. And here is seven. Yes. So, I think we must extend our condolences. Unfortunately, again, I lost track of that because of our traditions, regrettable. We don't feel bad about them, but that is the limitation. As well as the incident that happened, I think we did, although extend our words of condolences to those families, for those mine workers that were burned beyond recognition in Bakersfield. So it has not been a nice industry, especially for this year. I think I must say so. Lastly, I think in the same line, the Sorbab Nondaba no Khasmeni, we must say this thing. The issue of Lily Mine seems to be another issue that down the line again we may be able to invite you to explain, because we get different reports, and the difficulty for you when you are in a committee and you assume you are in charge, you then get these things and people ask questions and you are unable to answer. It then raises questions whether is it not a challenge on your side of an incapacity or what. I've read the articles, I think, about Monday, about Lily Mine. Unfortunately, it was absolutely bland. I think it is appropriate, again, let me make that request, that on some of the issues, you don't have to come to the committee to brief. Just a statement or an information to say these are the developments with regards to this particular issue, so that even when committee members they get that information, it can be shared with them, so that we say things that are relevant. At this stage, I've heard that there were people that have made the purchase, and there's a business rescue practitioner that says there's a certain amount that is sufficient and that is enough. Now they can start doing work, and probably they will start the recovery of those three, which obviously now there's no way they will be surviving. They'll start the recovery next year. It's just something that I got, I read it over the news. If someone asked me why next year, January or so, I can't tell what is the reason. I've heard the reasons that they are trying to, reopen or open a new shaft or shafts, yes. But it's important just to have something that gives us notice in black and white on the developments with regards to that, if there is any breakthrough. I'm just saying so that we don't always call you to come here, make a presentation now on the developments on Lily Mines. On the information we get, we can then be able to say, well, we think you can come and assist the committee by presentations on the questions they will need to ask, because it remains a sensitive matter. Being the case as it may, can we now go to apologies?
Good morning, honorable members and the guests. I've got apologies from Mr. Chafter, Mr. Khawula, and Dr. Nicole, and the apology from the minister and the DG. Thank you.
Okay. And then apologies noted. Okay. Okay, being the case as it may, we We will be dealing with two issues, obviously, except if there is any other matter that members believe we might have to entertain with extreme agency. We'll be dealing with the presentation on by DMR on progress in resolving issues that are related to Section 54 with regards to compliance by the industry on laws and regulations, as the DMR's response on the proposals by the Chamber of Mines. And then we will then get a briefing from the committee support and supported by legal services on the issue with regards to progress with state capture, and then we will close the sessions of the meeting. Oh, no, but minutes are standard. That's why I didn't read apologies. They want minutes to be also recorded to be an item for the day, including minutes. Do you agree, honorable members?
Agree, Chair.
Okay. DMR.
Honorable Chairperson and honorable members, DMR colleagues, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. We'll be presenting to the committee on the Section 54. And the presentation outline will go as follows. We'll firstly discuss the introduction, which will also cover the objectives of the enforcement provisions. And then thereafter we'll discuss all the enforcement provisions in the Mine and Safety Act. And that will also highlight the appeal process that we have in the Mine and Safety Act. We'll also share with the committee some of the steps on the number of Section 54 and 55 that have been issued. And also highlight some of the historic interventions that have been discussed at mid-debt on Section 54. And then thereafter, I'll also highlight the DMR's response on the Chamber of Mines proposal on Section 54, and then we'll conclude. Mr. Nkula? Okay, thank you. If we can then move to the question, is that the enforcement measures in the management sector, the primary objective is to make sure that always to encourage the mining companies to make sure that they comply with the Mining and Safety Act. And by that we mean that if, for example, workers are not exposed to silica dust or dangerous environments, that means that the employees that will either be injured or contracted silicosis. And we strongly believe that the enforcement measures have assisted us in making sure that we are able to firstly reduce and ultimately eliminate occupational diseases, injuries, and fatalities. The third objective is that our enforcement measures have contributed in the reduction of fatalities and injuries in the mining sector. And also, Honorable Chairperson, we can just highlight that so far this year we have had 34 fatalities as compared to 34 last year, which means that so far this year we haven't had any reduction compared to 2017. And like you said, that one of the main contributors was the accident that happened at Masakane shaft, which is owned by Sibanye Stillwater, where seven employees were killed. And if one looks at the general trend of the fatalities in the industry, if one had to compare 2007 and 2017, we've seen a gradual reduction from 219 in 2007 to 88 in 2017. And that gives us an overall reduction of about 60%. And the mining industry, in the Mining and Safety Summit that was held in 2016, we committed ourselves in making sure that we are able to achieve the goal of zero harm. And I can also highlight that we've got mining companies that operate for more than a year without a fatality. That's why I strongly believe that it's possible for us to be able to achieve the goal of zero harm. Our inspectors, they go out to mines to conduct audits normally in a group of them, as well as inspection. And the main objective of those audits and inspections is to make sure that the mines have got adequate health and safety management systems and the working conditions as well. Now, moving to the enforcement measures that are provided for in the Mining and Safety Act. The first one is what we call a Section 54. And Section 54 was intended to give inspectors powers for them to be able to deal with dangerous conditions in a mine. And after they've assessed the working environment on the mine, the inspector can either decide to stop a section of the mine or the whole mine. And also inspectors can stop an act or unsafe practice. The second enforcement provisions in the Act is Section 55, and that one is used to make sure that a mine must comply with the provisions of the Act and regulations. And when an inspector gives that instruction, the mine is also informed that they need to comply within a specified time period. And just to make an example, if a mine has failed to submit their annual medical report to the department, normally what the department would do initially is to send a reminder to the mine to say that they need to submit the report to the department, and if they have not submitted that report within a specified time period, the inspector can recommend it to the principal inspector an administrative fine, which will vary in terms of the amount. And the maximum admin fine that can be imposed on a mining company, it's R1 million per transgression, which also implies that if a mining company had more than one transgression, that means it can impose multiple fines. And honorable members, what's so important for me to highlight is that before the inspector also makes a final decision, the mine management are also given a chance for them to make that representation to the inspector to say why must the inspector not impose any of these enforcement measures as part of their mitigating factors. And then I'll move it to the appeal process. The appeal process in principle, again, is to make sure that there are checks and balances within the system to make sure that the system is not abused by our inspectors. Firstly, is that after an inspector has imposed one of the enforcement measures, mine management can appeal to the chief inspector. And as part of the appeal process is that both the mine management and inspector, they need to make their motivation or representation to the chief inspector. And then the chief inspector will have to assess the motivations that have been presented to him. And then thereafter, he can either confirm the decision of the inspector, set it aside, or vary the decision of the inspector, or completely come up with a completely new decision. And thirdly, is that if the mining company is still not happy with the decision that was taken by the chief inspector, they can appeal that decision to the labor court. And again, the labor court can either confirm, vary, or set aside the decision of the chief inspector. And then the next two slides will just give us an overview of the number of instructions that were issued in the mining sector. The first slide shows us the number of instructions that were issued in 2015 and 2016. And there were 1,141 Section 54s issued and 1,306 Section 55 instructions that were issued. And also just to highlight how many instructions were issued in our, what I'll call our big provinces, starting with the Northwest Rustenburg, they issued 158 Section 54 instructions. The second one is Gauteng, they issued 152, and then lastly, which is Mpumalanga, and they issued 154 Section 54 instructions. And then on the next slide, on slide 7, in 2016-2017, we issued 2,027 Section 54 instruction and 2,714 Section 55 instructions. And if I can highlight that in 2017, the department only received two appeals that were received by the chief inspector in 2017. And then moving to slide 8, is that the Mining and Industry Growth and Development Employment Task Team. The MIGDEF consists of a DMR, labor unions, and by labor unions I mean NUM, AMCU, Solidarity, and OASA, as well as the employers, which will be mainly the Chamber of Mines, affiliated companies, and SAMDA. And the MIGDEF is chaired by the DG. And as early as in 2012, there were concerns that were raised by the industry with the concerns allegation that there was an abuse of the Section 54 instruction. And the principals in MIGDEF decided to establish a task team to ascertain if there is any abuse of the Section 54 instruction. And they were given terms of reference. And one of the key issues, again, was to confirm if there is any abuse of the Section 54 within the Mine Health and Safety Act. And then on the second slide, after the investigation, it came out that there were no really substantial evidence that there was an abuse of the Section 54 system. I also need to highlight that I'm not saying that this system is perfect. The mining industry does raise concerns from time to time, but there was no evidence that there was a substantial abuse of the Section 54 instruction. And then on slide 10 is that in October last year, we also received a proposal from the Chamber of Mines on how the department must issue the Section 54 instruction. And the proposal from the Chamber of Mines was rejected by the department because we felt that that particular protocol that was proposed by the Chamber of Mines was inconsistent with the statutory functions of the chief inspector. And also it borders on the fact that the mining companies now wanted to be a referee and a player when it comes to the manner in which the department is issuing Section 54. And again, the Chamber of Mines and the mining companies are strongly encouraged to engage the department on the concerns that they might be having on the way that the department is issuing the Section 54 instruction. Honorable Chair, in conclusion, again, we'd like to highlight that the enforcement measures are part of the mechanisms in making sure that we improve compliance to the Mining and Safety Act and the regulations. And we strongly believe that these enforcement measures have also assisted the department in making sure that we reduce occupational diseases, injuries, and fatalities in the mining industry. And we also, on a quarterly basis, convene meetings with the Platinum Group mining companies as well as individual companies to address any concerns that they might be having on the Section 54 and the other enforcement measures. And also the department also continue training our inspectors to make sure that they apply the system consistently and fairly across all the mining companies. Thank you, Chairperson.
Uhlelo lo ndaba. into engakuyenza kuphendo yidlela. Honorable members, there is a presentation from the department. The floor is yours. Sawubona Baba Matlala.
Yebo baba.
Siyabonga, siyaxolisa ukuqala ungekafiki.
Bonga mina.
Yeke siphinde sikwenze lokho.
Yeah, in future. You must not repeat it.
In future you're going to sit here.
It's such that we had an advocate in the house and another in Nkosi, so we thought when the two are present, so we thought that you were traditionally outvoted.
No, I was still sorting some of the issues.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought your hand was up, Honorable Schmidt, Honorable Rim, Honorable Mafolo. Ngaba ngolayini, immediately ngidlula ulayini. Honorable Nyambi, Honorable Mandela. Ngokuthatha kokulandelayo omunye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide number 7, slide number 6 and 7, I think it is, you give the statistics of the section 54s and the 55s. How many of the section 54s in total for 2016 to 2017 and 2015 to 2016 of the mines were totally closed? Where there were total shutdowns for both those years? And secondly, I do recall a court case in the High Court where it was found that the department had overreached in closing down a mine where they could just have closed certain sections of the mine. I don't see it in a reflection here, and I'm sure there are other instances as well where there's matters where the department was taken to court. So could you just enlighten us on that? And then thirdly, the protocol. You say that the department rejected the protocol of the chamber. What did that protocol entail? Is it a procedural measure or was it a substantive measure? What exactly did the protocol consist of?
I have similar questions. And I'm going to zero in on your stats. It's interesting looking at the differences in numbers between Section 54s imposed and Section 55s. And there's quite a wide regional variation. You'll see places like Gauteng where the numbers of the two sections are more or less equivalent. And then you compare that to Mpumalanga, for example, which has a huge number of Section 54s versus Section 55. And I, by way of background, the reason that we're concerned with Section 54s and the overuse is that anything that imposes extra burdens on mines means mines become less viable. We know this. For us, one of the biggest crises facing the industry at the moment is the potential loss of employment. We think that we're heading for even worse times than we have had coming up. So in this regard, it's very important for Section 54, which closes the entire mine, to be used as little as possible. So where there can be a Section 55 solution, obviously for us this is preferable. I see, you know, if you look at the figures in your first table, April 2015 to March 2016, you see the two standout regions there, Limpopo and Mpumalanga, where there's a much increased number of Section 54s versus Section 55s. This situation has changed in the following table, April 2016 to March 2017, where Limpopo is much more in balance, but the large proportional use of Section 54s in Mpumalanga has remained. That seems to me to indicate that there is a regional variation depending on the staff. Perhaps you can explain that. Perhaps you will tell me that it's just because of the different types of mines involved, but I'd like to hear you tell us more on that. just to amplify what my colleague has said about the court findings against the DMR on Section 54, as a result of that case, did the Health and Safety Inspectorate change its operating procedures in any way? Could you tell us how? And then the final part deals with the chamber protocol. I would very much like to see not only the chamber protocol, but also the DMR's written response to that. I think that would be very informative for us to see what the actual detail was on both those documents.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Mine is on slide number 5. I just want to know how long does it take the Chief Inspector of Mines to assess both representations? And then, did you ever find yourself as the department, maybe the mines jumping, going straight to labor court, as you find yourself in those situations? I'm just interested in this thing of Section 54. It was very good. It was going to help us if we could find how many mines were stopped as a whole, or stop an act of practice at a certain level, not as a whole. So it would really help us to know the emphasis of that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Also, I welcome the presentation by the department. Chair, looking at the work that is done by the inspectors on page 6 and page 7, I just want to know from the department that do they have enough inspectors to do this good work that they are doing? Also, I'm encouraged by the last page whereby they say there is also going to be a training of inspectors. I don't know whether they do have a program of some intakes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and we appreciate the presentation that has been put before us, and also welcome you back into the folio committee. Honorable Chair, if I can draw your attention on slide number 3, which talks to number of fatalities, which has been found to have dropped since 2007 to 2017 from 219 to 88, and that DMR seeks to achieve zero harm in the mining sector. My question therefore would be, Honorable Chair, do we actually have a strategy in place to achieve this zero harm? And if zero harm is actually attainable, because if you look at the figures, you would see that they have never actually dropped below 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, or even scratched anywhere close to that zero target. And this prompts, therefore, understanding or question of, is this actually really attainable? Maybe we benchmark it against 2020 vision or 2024, 2030 NDP vision. When will we actually achieve this zero harm reality? We also are dealing with other natural causes like seismic events, which we as a department are not in control of. So how do you really measure this issue of achieving zero harm within the mining sector? If I also dwell further on the issue of the inspectors which conduct audits and inspections, I'd like to understand how many inspectors does the DMR have, and how many audits have been conducted in terms of verifying if they are actually able to carry out all those inspections and carry out the audits that are necessary, as highlighted by the figures there. What are the challenges they face in carrying out these audits, Honourable Chair? And in terms of training inspectors, what does the training of inspectors entail, Honourable Chair? What institution are they trained at? You know, we find a lot of our people are given training and there's no really qualification behind that. What university do they get trained in? What qualification do they come out with? I'd like to understand that, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Starting with the questions that was raised there by
Starting with the question that was raised by Honourable Advocate Smith. In the two slides, we've just given an overview of the Section 54s, and I don't have with me the number when the whole mine was closed, but that information can be provided. This is just an overview of the Section 54s that were issued. That information can be made available to the committee. And then with regard to the court case, I've got my colleague Mr. Ndamse. You will assist us with that question. And as far as the Chamber of Mines protocol, it was more of a procedural a matter to say, as the department, can you please consider these facts when as part of us issuing the different enforcement measures. And Advocate Lorima, we have highlighted the difference between the number of Section 54s that were issued in Mpumalanga. If one looks at 2015-2016, is that in Mpumalanga issued 150 Section 54s and 8 Section 55s. Again, just highlight that in terms of Section 55, that is more to order a mine to comply with the provisions of the Act and regulations, which will also imply that there is a generally good compliance of mines in Mpumalanga. But when it comes to dealing with dangerous occurrences, that's when the inspector issued those instructions. So as far as the compliance with the Act is concerned, that's why they've issued about 8 instructions as compared to dealing with dangerous conditions at the mines. Again, in an ideal situation where mines comply 100% with the Act and regulations, there'll be very few Section 55s that will be issued. Honourable Mpholo, with regard to the processing of the appeals, is that once the mine and the inspectors, whether the chief inspector, with the information that we require, it will take at the most a day to 2 days for the chief inspector to be able to make the final decision. And with regard to the agent court appeals, I've also asked Mr. Ndamse to give us more information on that. Mr. Ngwenya, I can also assist us with the questions that were asked by Honorable Nyambi and Honorable Mandela. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Honourable Member. Let me start with the court cases. I have to inform this Honourable Committee that in terms of our records, our last case that we went to court, it was on an urgent application, and it was the Ashanti Gold matter. The Ashanti Gold matter, it was a case where the mine the mine went to court on an urgent basis. And this question will also be linked to the question that was asked by Honorable, in that are there cases that the mines jump to the labor court? Yes, that is the case. That mine did not follow. It decided to go to the labor court on that urgent basis, and yes, its court found that the proportionality, that we should have closed one part of the mine and not the whole mine. And then, but the argument was that what is happening at a certain place where it is clear and the mine is given time to go and conduct an audit to prove to us that what is dangerous at that place is not also dangerous in the same places because they have the same processes. And then we gave the mind that do that, and then we will then lift and give us an audit. But the mind then decided to go to court, and the court found that in terms of proportionality we shouldn't. But we were prepared to go back to court and argue that on merits, but now the mind doesn't intend going back to court because it has got what it wanted. The Section 54 was lifted, and therefore, which means they won the first round, and then the second round, we are not, the mine is not interested because there's nothing we can do. Now, yes, out of all that, on the CAT cases that have been there, as I've said, that was 2016, and now, if you look at the trend, which also we believe that we are doing something, in that there are no other cases that are coming to court, because we have also strengthened our internal processes, whereby, as we say, we keep on workshopping our inspectors in order that they, when they issue Section 54 instructions, they issue Section 54 instructions that are relied mostly on PAJA. We always give the other party the right to make good representations. And that is why you find that when it comes to appeals, there are no appeals. The mine doesn't appeal to the chief inspector because in what they have written there, in when they are asked, what do you say to this, when you give representation, it becomes clear. And therefore, if you now look at the statistics, Section 54s are 200, the appeals, it's 2 court cases, the last one is 1. Therefore, definitely there's something. We are getting somewhere when it comes to that. So we have, as I say, and one other thing that we should also look at, Section 54 is not one Section 54. There's Section 54-1A, where you close the whole mine. There are also Section 54-1C, which is similar or almost identical to Section 55, where you ask the mine to come back and give you reasons. So those are also, it's not just the plain 54. Now, also, if you look at the what we have put there, is that an inspector goes to the mine, he finds that there's a dangerous situation here, he then decides to issue a 1654-1A. But immediately after that, that inspector has to give it to the principal inspector, who then is the supervisor of the inspector. He then confirms or sets that aside. If he confirms, the mine can also immediately call the chief inspector to look at that 54. And then if the chief inspector believes that both the principal inspector and the inspector are not correct, then it sets it aside. And then if they are totally not satisfied with that, then they can appeal to that, they go to the labor court. So that is the problem that is there when it comes to Section 54. We believe that there are means that were put so that it cannot be abused. There are means that we put there so that people can, it can be practiced fairly. But the main problem is that what we realized was that we could jump into the courts, and then it is difficult for the department. If a Section 54 is issued at 4 o'clock, and then at 9 in the evening you get an email that at 10 you've got to be at a court for an urgent court basis. Obviously, it is difficult to defend such matters. So I believe that is what is on the court side. And, is there anything else? Okay, when it comes to the training part, we also said as a department, we were asked that Tulu should look at coming up with a legal framework that would basically look at empowering the inspectors, because obviously you'd understand inspectors, their main competency is on the engineering, whatever side, but not on the legal side. So that is where it might become a little bit of a challenge. So we are then having processes that we put together as a legal framework to train them on the legal side and also do it practically with them. And then also we've said we're going to, with the assistance of the Mine Health and Safety Council, we are developing a manual where it would come, we have different parts, we're starting from ethics and everything on how an inspector should behave himself when it does, and looking at all the different laws that he can apply to try and make it possible. And the last training that we had, the contact we used to have, was with the University of Winchester, where inspectors would go there to do the legal introduction to law and all those other courses. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I will comment on a few issues. In terms of the Section 54, it is in very few occasions where a 54 will be issued to stop all mining operations. Very, very few cases. Normally, Section 54 will be issued to address a certain issue, maybe support, explosives, maybe unsafe transportation at the mine. But in very few cases, I'll say less than 5% of the cases, you will find that the mine has been totally shut down. And in those cases, it will be mainly with our small-scale miners where no system whatsoever it is in place, nothing it is in place, from your legal appointments, your codes of practices, no procedures, people are not trained. That is when you can issue that type of instruction. But with our established mining companies, they do have, you know, comprehensive health and safety management system. What is lacking is implementation thereof from time to time. I'll also touch on the question from Honorable Nyambi and Honorable Mr. Mandela on the training. Our inspectors, or for our officials to become inspectors, they need to hold similar qualifications as mine managers. That will, most of them are holding mining engineering degrees and also certificates of mine managers. Now, the department struggles to retain officials with those skills because mines are also trying to attract them to join the private sector. And unfortunately, in terms of remuneration, government cannot match what the private sector offers. And hence, from time to time, as the department, we struggle to recruit and retain inspectors, because once we recruit them, they are poached by the mining sector. And in terms of the training program, what we do have a memorandum of understanding with Goldfields Academy, where we take graduates in mining engineering or electrical engineering or geology to go and get exposure with Goldfields Academy for a period of 2 years. And thereafter, they go through an assessment test where they need to write an examination for government. It's a government certificate of competency for engineers or for mine managers.
but those qualifications are exactly similar with mine managers. So our inspectors, in terms of competence, they are the same as mine managers. There was also a question from Honorable Mandela in terms of the challenges which inspectors are encountering whilst conducting their audits. In some mines, particularly small mines, you find that some mining operators, they just close the gates to ensure that the inspector doesn't have access into the mine. And in some remote areas, particularly in alluvial diamond mines, you find the managers who are also farmers, you know, carrying guns in the presence of inspectors. So that is intimidating to the inspectors. In other instances, the inspectors will issue instructions and mines would not comply. And you'll find that the mine is about 500 kilometers from the office. So they know that it's difficult for the inspector to go back and verify if the instruction has been complied with. So those are some of the challenges inspectors encounter from time to time. And in terms of where training is conducted, it is with the Goldfields Academy and also internally. And when it comes to issues of seismicity, it is correct that we don't have total control over seismicity. But most incidents of seismicity in the mining sector are self-inflicted. You know, the type of mining method you use, the rate at which you mine can influence seismicity. And gold mines in particular are now running out of reserves, unfortunately, which forces them to consider mining isolated pillars, which previously they were left unmined because of the high risk. Now that there are, many companies are out running out of reserves, they are venturing into those high-risk areas. And that is where we see most of the incidents of seismicity, which are killing our mine workers. And in terms of whether we do have a strategy to achieve zero harm or not, we do, in collaboration with the Mine Health and Safety Council, where Chamber of Mines, Organized Labor, and City. Every second year, we do convene a summit where we set milestones, health and safety milestones for the industry, for all the three stakeholders, which we aspire to achieve. So, as the department, like the acting chief inspector has said, we believe strongly that zero harm is possible. Many mines have worked, you know, from the first day up to the last day without anybody losing their lives. Others, they work for the full calendar year without even a minor injury occurring at the mine. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Members. I will start with the issue of training, and then in addition what Ms. Benguenya has said with regards to training, for the new inspectors, when they arrive at the department, we conduct a three-day induction course where they are taken through all the activities of the inspectorate and the methods of doing that. And then after that, they go to the mines with the senior inspectors for a period of 6 months for on-the-job coaching and training. That is with regards to training. And then coming back to the issue of closing the whole mine. So the Section 54 would be issued to close the whole mine when there's a death of a person at the mine. That is one instance. Then the other instance, if there's an accident in a shaft, maybe a pipe fell down the shaft, because the shaft is the main access to the mine. So if that accident happens while the employees, they are not underground, so that mine is going to be stopped until they have assessed the integrity of the shaft before they can put people down the mine. So it's only in those instances where the whole mine is closed in terms of Section 54. And before a Section 54 is issued, in the department, we've got legal admin officers
where they advise the inspectors whether this instruction will be sound and just and fair. Thank you.
I'd like to just make these two examples. In 2016, two employees were killed by fall of ground at one of the Impala shafts, right? And it took the mine close to 2 weeks before those employees could be recovered. And during those 2 weeks, the mine was not operating. Another extreme example is Lily Mine, right? Is that after that accident, the mine had to be closed, and more than 300 employees lost their jobs. Because what I want to emphasize is that these enforcement measures are proactive means to prevent accidents and harm from happening to workers. Because once there's an accident, it's too late. There's nothing to do as a department. We're trying to prevent harm from happening to workers. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Hello. Okay.
I'm not sure if I understood the answer on the Chamber of Mines protocol and the paperwork. Can we see that paperwork or does it not exist? Could you just clarify that for me? I am concerned that with the current state of the industry, and one of the answers is very interesting about people mining Pilsner, is that as mines start working less and start harvesting and spending less capital. We all know that when a mine isn't mined regularly, it becomes more dangerous. Are you expecting this kind of accident to go up as we move into this phase? It would seem to me as less capital is spent, mines just become more dangerous to operate. Less capital is being spent and harvesting of these pillars. So are you expecting more accidents because of that? Then I want to just address the issue of when there is a total mine closure, I have heard that one of the big problems is that even when issues have been rectified, there is a long delay sometimes in, for example, securing meetings with the DMR, over a weekend, something like that. And in a big mine, this can mean the loss of millions and millions, which, is fine apart from the fact that it does make the mine less viable and put jobs at risk. That's what the concern is. So is there a sort of a protocol, is the DMR aware of this? Is there a protocol to try and get mines back on stream once they are compliant?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Minister made mention of 26 Section 52 notices issued by mines. That is when, as I understand it, the profitability of the mine drops to below, 5%? 6% over a period of continuous 12 months, or when more than 500 workers or 10% of the workforce is about to be retrenched after a discussion with the labor unions. Is there a factual or a statistical basis, I'm asking because I don't know what the answer is, between notices by mines in terms of Section 52 of the MPRDA and these kind of incidents taking place? Have you discovered or have you established or tried to establish whether there's a mine that runs into trouble, financial trouble, and increase in fatalities or injuries or Section 54s or Section 55s? Is there a correlation? Thank you. But it was 26, I think it was, in terms of Section 52. 26 mines, 26.
Okay.
Honourable Chair, I'll start with the question that was raised by Honourable Advocate Schmidt. So far, we have been, firstly, we are not aware of such a link between the mines that had to be closed because of Section 54. I think the main reason is that most of them have run out of their ore body. That is one of the contributing factors. We haven't had such an incident. And then with regard to the appeal process and the possible delays, the mining companies have raised those concerns from time to time. and we have addressed them through our management meeting to say if the PI is not there for him to be able to review the appeal by the mine, the DC must delegate it to one of the senior inspectors. We had those concerns before, and we did deal with them internally in the department to say, you know what, if the PI is not available, he mustn't be the only one who will be able to process the appeal from the mine. So we've dealt with that one as far as possible as the department.
Thank you. Let me answer on the protocol. You're looking for the paperwork. let me just give you the background, a little bit of a background on this protocol. The protocol, it was the Platinum Group that is from the Northwest who decided that they would come up with a protocol advising the department, or in fact asking the department to follow its protocol that they have devised on how to issue Section 54. This protocol was then again given to the chief inspector, and the chief inspector looked at it and then he then forwarded it to the other internally. And there were meetings that were held, but no agreements were there. We could not follow that. And then that protocol was then now formally discussed at the Mine Health and Safety Council board meeting, where it was debated, where the Chamber of Mines introduced the protocol, and all other parties debated on the protocol, labor as well as the DMR. So which means all parties had different stances on it. And the DMR stance was that this protocol cannot work. The mining industry cannot come to be, it is tantamount to self-regulation, in fact. Because you're now telling us, as the regulator, that this is how you must regulate us. And then so that when we start regulating you and we miss one point, then the first point, the place that you're going to go to is to the courts. And then obviously we would know, we wouldn't be able to defend that. So that protocol, I think the file on that, Mr. Zondi, will be able to give it to you, and the discussions that took place at the Mine Health and Safety Council. Thank you.
Okay. And another thing, what we are doing in the department, we are busy drafting an enforcement manual. And then that manual is going to be, once it has been approved, and then all the inspectors, they are going to be workshopped on that manual. So that manual is basically all the activities that are happening in the inspectorate will be in that manual. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. There was also a question from Honorable Lorima on whether we are expecting incidences of seismicity to increase. As a department, we do not. Because not every ground should be mined underground. For instance, if you look at the Lily mine disaster, someone decided to overmine a crown pillar, which was acting as a structural support for the mine. So once you mine a crown pillar, for instance, chances are the underground workings will collapse. And there has been many cases like the Coalbrook mine disaster, where over 420 people got killed, where underground pillars collapsed. They had a domino effect when they failed, and over 420 people died as a result. So we expect mines to, you know, act responsibly. If the ground, it is too dangerous to be mined, it should be classified as such, to say this is unminable ground, instead of putting people in grounds which everybody knows that they are likely to be killed. Thank you.
Okay. Abuzond. Let me start here. That it depends, all of us here, where do we stand on this matter? And at times I get worried that there is no sensitivity or emotions that are attached to it. Before I go to this thing, I'm not sure whether from the introduction I'm in agreement with you. Maybe you are saying what is being said by the department, and it's not, I don't think it's fair to you, but because you represent the department, it would have been nice. You can't do what you say here. Mine Health and Safety Act enforcement measures objectives are to, just the first bullet, encourage and ensure compliance with the Mine Health and Safety Act. Except if I have a problem with understanding English. First, maybe we must ask a question, why did we have to have the Mine Health and Safety Act? Because I will not get the answer here. Honorable Mandela says, you say you want your main achievement objective is to have zero harm. Now, English is a very difficult thing to go with. There is a difference, that's why Honorable Mandela, I may be too deeper. I don't want to say in difference with you. There is a difference between harm and a fatality. Harm is almost equivalent to injury. That's true, because English can be very polite as a word. You see? It depends on the emphasis. Now, to harm someone is different. You can't harm something that is dead. That's why I said we need to ask a question. What are we dealing with here? We are dealing with death. And as long as we don't want to be straightforward, the question that then I have is a simple one. Does the act assist us to stop, because when we say fatality is a very nice English, to stop death of people who go to work and don't come back alive? All of us, I can assure you, all of us when we are here, leave the fact that others, it was a raise of hands, there was no CV submitted. All of us here, when we wake up, you say you go to work. Now, if I were to say I go to work and then the next thing I'm told, this building here just collapsed over us and some of us died, surely there will be an uproar. Then the question will be asked, are these buildings safe for us to work here? I'm saying this report, unfortunately, is not, I'm not saying you, ne? But from your side, it's not helping us to tell us what is it. That's why I said it's a very emotive and a very sensitive matter. Only some people may not have a heart. I can't, as we move here, I can assure you, before the end of this month or the next month, you can have other workers who will die again. Now, if you say, I want to come from this thing, if you say between January until now, you've got 35 people who are dead on the mines, maybe we then have to check the statistics. How many mines do we have so that we make an average? That's why I don't want to use this word fatalities, because it's a very nice English. You see, it's nice, a fatality, it's not death. And there are different types of death. There is death that you could call it deliberately. It's murder. even a murder, you can call it, it's premeditated murder, because some people should have known and should have seen the danger, but they would not have acted. And therefore, it can't be something that it happened because people didn't plan. Now, does this act, does this help us? Now, that is to me the first thing that I have as a problem in this. So, if we can't define what was the act meant for, if the act was meant to curb or to stop death on our minds, is it assisting us? You may have reduced your deaths from 219, but still to have 88 people who die. I always say the problem is in that, in this industry, that people are more possible to die in the mines than in the army. When people go to the army, they are rifles. You see, those people are expected. When you say a soldier is dead, yes, we get shocked. We'll deal with the circumstances of death, but there is no one who could be a soldier who is not who doesn't expect to go to war and die, even if he's killing. The problem is when they can't kill, they can be killed. That's the only thing. It's not optional that you can kill or not be killed. Now, that is the issue. That's why I said Honorable Mandela talks about harm. I'm saying that harm is just lost time injuries can be included to harm. Now, can we get something concrete? We will come to what is supposed to be done. Secondly, you had, I will make an example again. You. To me, I don't get a sense, Section 54, ne? It seems to me is more, the report is more as a preventative measure. Which section then deals with consequential measures? You see, I may agree with honorable members that you should act responsible. But how do you explain when 150 workers are underground simply because there was a lack of a generator that was destroyed because of floods? Let's leave the fact that they survived. Even if you were to take the recent case of Sibanye, Stillwater, in the area that you mentioned, they were not suffering. Now, what would have happened if all those people had perished? Because there might be a time where the entire, if you've got, like it would have happened, nearly happened, you would have had about 150, ne? In the incident of the Eskom, whatever, where there was no generator. And then the actual people that would say they were trapped for a major longer period were 98. And then the number reduced, but it was never less than 38. Now, if those people had perished, what would we do sitting here and say, no, we've got an act in front of us? So where are the areas that have got consequential effect? Now, I'll give you an example. If there is, whether it's a shootout or whatever, that area gets condoned, ne? And nothing happens until the police would have finalized their investigations. You can go to the Occupational Health and Safety, it's provided for the Department of Labor, where there have been fatalities, the area gets condoned, and for a certain period. Is there such a provision here? Because there are two things. It might be easy to be challenged pre-occurrence of an event, but what happens post when the event has occurred? I don't get that sense. So I because for me, the actual interpretation of the act is on the basis of its own foundation, why you needed the act, and is it achieving its intended objective. And the point I'm raising is that at times what we will miss is that when there is non-compliance, the potential of others then saying, if so and so can do it and without consequences, why should I comply too? Now, you gave us steps, ne? You said 35. Who is the highest culprit in this 35? And how many? Because we must get, this 35 might be including coal, platinum, and so forth. Can you give us that of this 35, which sector, and by that sector is it gold, and if by that sector is gold, who are these companies? Because you can't tell me that out of 35 is one person per each mine, or per each mining company. Can you get a sense? Secondly, if you have not prepared, can you get a sense of the basis, just an average, what would have been the basis of those incidences? You see? And linked to that, besides the basis of those incidences, where do you think, because for me, the, what do they call these things, proto teams and so forth, some of the areas, if you had not had strong systems in place, the rescue missions would have failed. And you know, when it's what's inside, which incidences are like that. I would have loved to go to your stats because to some degree they worry me. Frankly speaking, they worry me. Not in a negative way. I'm not sure whether I read properly. Gauteng, which in my view, ne, is supposedly to be the worst. And I'm saying Gauteng is supposedly to be the worst symbol because that's where you've got gold mines. So I wouldn't know whether gold mines is the numbers that are less. But if you look at your instances of these major occurrences, it is Gauteng and the Free State, specifically Velkom. But when I look at your stats, there is more, and that's why I said, please make me be at ease. When you combine Rustenburg in Northwest and Klerksdorp, they are more than Gauteng, except if my statistics are wrong. I look at your Otio Gauteng is 152, that is section 54. That is your 2015-2016. It's 152, section 54. In Klerksdorp alone, it's 165, and in Rustenburg is 258. Now I'm saying I do this in the context of understanding that in Gauteng mainly, it's where we might be having a problem in terms of, now, it helps me to see whether are we not focusing, I'm not saying platinum and the rest are not correct, but are we not, it's not a problem that we are focusing on areas where we may not have a major problem comparatively to an area where we've got a problem statistically wise. So I'm just raising those things, but no number, because I feel that it's a matter that it should concern us. The last thing is that maybe we must not throw it to you. You'll bear with me, honorable members. I've not read. I've just read it only again, unfortunately, on a flight when I was reading your debate and so forth. Something that says the minister, and we don't want to start from a point that we might be left out. The minister, in my view, has to come to the committee. He said amongst the priorities, if I'm correct, was the issue which was a concern on mine health and safety. Now we're sitting here, we were told there is a bill that is sitting, one moment it was at NEDLAG, one moment is somewhere else. we now end up discussing Section 54, and I think Honorable Rolumo was making a point. Shouldn't we get the department to say, if it is elevating the issue of mine health and safety, where is it now? So that we don't deal with Section 54 today, and then another day we are told there's Section so-and-so on mine health and safety. Can you ascertain from your principals, which we will do, when do you anticipate to bring and finalization, so that even ourselves here, we express our differences on the matter of how do we protect the lives of those who go underground in order to put bribe. That's why I'm saying it's different from which angles we come from. Surely for me, I will come from an angle that someone, when goes out, we took a conscious decision to end trade in the mining industry by asbestos, simply because it was an undesirable thing, regardless of the consequences which have led to job losses. I understood that debate because there was a long debate then. Others said, no, but you are going to make people lose their jobs. Now, it's a question of the value of a life vis-a-vis the value of a job. Which one do you, because there is an allegation and accusation all the time to say profits are always put above and ahead of safety. We have as parliament to confront that reality. Is it something that we also fall on that trap? Do we have a problem of, I always say, for me to give me a ticket of 2,500 because I was driving at 150 when I know them of 155, when I know that the speed limit is 120, surely you can't blame the traffic officer for giving me a ticket for 2,500 and say it's too much, because I should have known that it is wrong to travel at a speed that is quite excessive. So even if tomorrow I get arrested for that, don't sympathize with me, because I should have known the law. You see, I don't think we can, so we must have that discussion. Do we have a problem with enforcing the law? And what is it so that we can assist to enforce the law? Obviously, what is good in the industry, it's a law that is done in consultation. But finally, there has to be a law. So I thought I must just raise this thing to say, can you tell the minister that we request to understand where is the process of the act, of the amendments to the act, and when can they be able to come and present to us, so that we deal holistically with this matter. Otherwise, we will be genuinely accused, correctly so, if in Parliament we are seen as not caring about what we see in the industry. We can't. If you say 35 now, there is a potential that will be much higher. By the way, the 35 you measure on the basis of a 34, not on the basis of your own target, which is zero. So we should be saying, what was supposed to be the target as well, 35 now? What would have been the target? Was it supposed to be 25 or 20? So that we can see. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Firstly, with regard to the Mines and Safety Act, we strongly believe that our current act is currently adequate for it to be able to prevent fatalities and injuries in the mining industry. And as there are technological improvements in the mining industry, those will also enhance on the way that we're able to prevent accidents in the mining industry. With regard to the fatalities that have occurred so far in the mining industry, I would like to highlight the top four mining companies that have had fatalities in the mining industry. The first one is Sibanye Stillwater. They're currently standing at 14, and that is including now the seven that were killed at Masakane Shaft. The next mining company is Harmony, which is a gold mining company, is currently standing at five. The third mining company is Sasol Mining. They've had three fatalities, and all of them occurred Okay, they are only a coal mining company. And then the fourth one is Anglo Gold Ashanti, which is a coal mining company. So far they've had two this year. And with regard to the different commodities, the gold sector is has got the highest, and they are currently at 19. The other mines, which will include your diamond, the iron ore quarries, manganese, and others, they are at 6. The coal sector had 5 so far, and then the platinum sector had 4 fatalities. That will give us the chairperson. It's 34 so far this year. And then with regard to the other issues that we have raised, I would like to request Mr. Damster to assist us with the amendment bill, as well as the criminal liability that was proposed as part of the deal. And then the other question, I request Mr. Nguyen to assist us with them.
Thank you, Honourable. Yes, the Mining and Safety Act, it is an act that is based mainly on trying to prevent. But it is true that when it comes to after the act, the sections that we have, for instance, the criminal liability section, that is 86.1A, was put in abeyance, and which would have put the CEO or any other person responsible or negligently responsible for that any death that has occurred at the mine would be guilty of an offense. And that is why at the amendment bill, we were hoping the objective was to strengthen the parts of those sections, looking also at the, because we would find that the other sections that are there in terms of Section 91, when you are criminally charged, are only sections that are, for instance, you would find that a person could be found guilty and sentenced to 3 months imprisonment and a certain amount of fine or a suspension, which would, looking at the act itself, it is not, I wouldn't say it reconciles with such an act, which is heinous, that, as you say, correctly puts it, that it borders on murder. So that was the basis of the amendment bill, to strengthen that and also to make the mines be to feel the pinch whenever that is, when there is a death at the mine. One other, the process that is quite a little bit cumbersome, so that would put you to doubt what we do. Because after any incident or death that has occurred at the mine, we have to investigate. We conduct an investigation whereby after the investigation, we have looked at the act, and then we can, if everything is clear, we can send it to the Director of Public Prosecutions to see whether he can prosecute or not. Or sometimes we then decide to open up an inquiry. And then it is only after the inquiry when we also give that report to the Director of Public Prosecutions. Then it is there that becomes a problem, because the inquiry looks at what has actually happened in terms of the act and then makes recommendations to the Director of Public Prosecution. Then the director on the other side, his only aim is whether to charge that person criminally, and looks at how did we prove whether there's murder or not. Then there is a little bit of That is why we always try by all means to have meetings with the Director of Public Prosecution. Yes, we do recommend prosecution, but the question would be what happens after that. The director, there are many matters that are taken to court, and they are given to district courts and so, but I think the main problem is that it never after that is given out for people to read that there's this that has happened, of which I think that is something we should be looking at. But it definitely needs the consequential sections have to be strengthened, that I believe it's true. And I think that is all. Thank you, sir.
Okay. In the Mine Health and Safety Act, currently there's a provision which requires employers and employees not to tamper with the scene of an accident. Immediately after fatality, the mine is expected to notify the department, and within 72 hours, the department must have dispatched an inspector to go and conduct an in-loco inspection. And there are some instances where the in-loco inspection couldn't be completed, say, within 72 hours, and that period can be extended. But immediately after the fatality, the scene of the accident must be barricaded off or cordoned off until the department comes and they conduct the in-loco inspection. But unfortunately, from time to time, some employers will take chances and try to tamper with the scene of the accident to make sure that they conceal, you know, some evidence. And because the officials of the department are not there, if we are not told by anyone, more especially employees, we wouldn't know. But from time to time, we hear those rumors to say when these people were killed, the conditions were different from what the inspector saw during the in-loco inspection. And just to add on what my colleague just said, in terms of our relationship with the Director of Public Prosecutions, most of the time after our inquiries, we do recommend prosecution, but the outcome we get from the DPP's office, they always decline to prosecute, and they normally don't provide reasons why they decline to prosecute, and that is why when the minister was making his budget vote speech last week, he even mentioned that the department will need to collaborate more with the DPP's office to ensure that where there's negligence, people are criminally prosecuted. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. When can the minister come with the act here? You want us to
ask him on your behalf. They sent you here.
Honorable Chair, we'll have to make a follow-up to say at what stage is the bill and what needs to be done to make sure that the whole process is finalized. We'll raise it to the Minister's office.
Honorable Member, whilst we're waiting for you, the duty is on us. Should we ask the Minister? Honorable Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, yes. I just would like to, I think Mr. Zondi has said, if I heard him correctly, that he said that there's no, the arrangement or the act provides for issues pertaining to mine health and safety, except if I misunderstood him. Because the question I would like to know is, if we want the minister to come to the committee, then what is the purpose of the new bill? Because if the purpose of the new bill is to give it a new number and a new name, and criminalize certain of the actions or lack of actions by, let's say, CEOs or whatever, then surely this bill could be amended as well. I'm just trying to get behind the reasoning for a new act. I'm not sure I understand why a new act. Why can't we amend it? If that is the only issue which I've heard being raised for a new act, if you follow what I'm saying, is the criminality of certain individuals.
You know why? That's exactly why I said maybe they can continue, because like the submission initially said, if we're to be crude, I don't want to push them against the wall. They said there's nothing wrong with the act, it can be implemented now, but the problem still persists. But most importantly, is it a problem you didn't introduce to Mr. Dumse?
Dumse,
yes. If I listen to him correctly, then makes mention of a consequential clause, which is section 81, 86. That 86.1 that has been put, I don't know, in abeyance. The problem now is that we are dealing with a serious matter which requires facts. I wouldn't take his word for an example that there is a certain section that is sitting there. That's why myself I said, maybe it's better to deal with the real issue, so that even that question that you are raising, what informed the need for the basis of proposed amendment on the main Mine Health and Safety Act. Until such time we address that question, we may deal with Section 54 today, tomorrow we'll be dealing with something else under the Mine Health and Safety, under the Mine Health and Safety. Maybe when we get, maybe not the presentation on the Act itself, but the basis, if we take what to say, the basis of proposed amendments, so that as a committee, when they come to present amendments, because I think that with that intervention of yours, it now brings back something, that this thing of being brought a bill or an amendment, a bill, it only confronts you because you have mechanically and administratively to process. But the intentions, unfortunately, have not dealt with it exactly. So that when it is brought now as a bill, as an amendment bill, we can then understand why. Then you deal with ease, was, and all those technicalities, having had a political discussion, if I were to use that word, on the basis and the requirements for this thing. Maybe that's why I said it might be too much for them to answer this question, is to ask the minister to come and brief the committee on the need as to whether is there a need or no need to make amendments, and if that, how far is that process, and what are the key issues to look at as a committee. Can we take it that way? It doesn't take away that you must continue and report to your principal. Okay, honorable members, if that is the case,
any move?
Okay. Oh, Dams, I must make this thing again. When something is raised in this committee and there is no contrary or different view, unfortunately it becomes a decision of the committee. Ne? Now, a member of this committee asked for an information. You said there is no problem. I'm not speaking on your behalf, but that decision now stands because you said there is no problem. Please don't come back tomorrow and say you will then have to consult with your principal and therefore you were told it's a sensitive information. I'm just making you aware. I'm not sure to what extent are you capacitated to take that decision of a consultation by parties led by, I assume, the executive authority. So I'm just making you aware that together with Lunda, you didn't say, no, you can't. You all made a commitment. We will tell you, the only thing, you didn't give a time frame, but surely next week we'll be discussing that report when we deal with the minutes. That information has not reached the committee. So when a member, Honorable Lorima, asks for that information, it doesn't become the information for him now, it becomes an information for the committee. Because if it's for him, he won't be able to come back to the committee and say, I have not received. So it becomes a committee decision, unfortunately. And that's a commitment you have made to the committee. On that note, can we take a 10 minutes comfort break and then we come back exactly at 11?